It's directed by Mitsu Murayama, and the effects are this time handled by Turo Matoba. It's well put together. It's a nice little crime story that zips along at a nice pace. And so this is a two-film desk from Arrow Films, The Invisible Man Appears and The Invisible Man versus the Human Fly. Now, but the only extra in this is a little interview with British writer Kim Newman. And he kind of just sort of gives an overall view of Invisible Man movies in general. But what's really cool is a very nice booklet, which is included in the set, which gives a nice background on the Japanese film industry, the influence of the interest in the Invisible Man, and all sorts of interesting stuff in the booklet. So that's from Arrow Films, The Invisible Man Appears.
Thanks, Matthew. And thanks for listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland. Film at 11 will be back next week.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Hey, Michael here. I'm with the Tin Can Phone Podcast, a radio show where you can hear about the influence incarceration has straight from the source. We tell you the story from the inside out. So make sure to check us out on KBOO Community Radio every first Tuesday at 10 a.m.
Why, I'm all in the ground, I'd root that mountain down, and I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Tune in to KBOO Monday mornings at 9 for the Old Mole Variety Hour, your source for radically democratic news, views, reviews, and interviews, stories of ordinary and extraordinary people working to root down the oppressive institutions of capitalism. That's the Old Mole Variety Hour, Monday mornings at 9.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM.
Welcome to Out of the Streets of Portland, a podcast focused on sharing the stories of people who are currently or formerly homeless in our community and helping navigate the systems and services that the Joint Office of Homeless Services and its partners either have in place or are developing to help people move out of homelessness and back into stable, supportive housing. Today on the podcast, we'll explore the impact of the Supportive Housing Services Measure passed by metro area voters in 2020. The 10-year region-wide program goals include connecting 5,000 chronically homeless households with supportive housing, building new outreach teams, stabilizing 10,000 households experiencing or at risk of homelessness in permanent housing, and expanding the network of culturally specific service providers. In 2023, Multnomah County met most of the annual goals set by Metro for implementation of the Supportive Housing Services Measure, and 99% of people housed in 2022 remained in housing a year later. We'll speak with Crystal Otero of the Supportive Housing Services team at the Joint Office of Homeless Services to find out more. But first, we'll hear from Jessica, who recently got into housing thanks to funding from the Supportive Housing Services Measure. She was supported by provider Do Good Multnomah and volunteers with PDX Saints Love, an organization that provided her help and support on the street and where she now works doing outreach and peer support.
My name is Jessica. I was born in Central Oregon, and about 14 is when I became homeless. I was already like rambunctious, just wanted to go and do my own thing anyway. And that was a short-lived lesson for like 2 days. Yeah, I realized how hard it was to actually exist. My first, I love my mom, she's my best friend, but I had a street mom out there that ranks just as high. She took in a lot of street rats is what we call them. That was the good portion of when I was like underage and homeless, but then I don't know, everywhere that I've gone, I've always flocked into, you always want to camp with somebody else, even if your stuff gets taken, it's better than having something else happen. But community's pretty flourishing, I guess, out there. You just got to be a part of it. I'd frequently visited over at the Holgate area, and I was riding down the bike trail when I had seen somebody I knew. Their camp was getting cleaned up from rapid response, and I knew somebody prior that had mentioned that's who I needed to talk to get into the villages. And I stopped and talked to them, and within an hour they had me in my own pod, getting me a taxi to get taken over there. And it was pretty fast. It was I got in, my intake was only like 15 minutes, and then they showed me my room and I moved in. Being in the village was it's almost like an uprooting kind of feeling. Having my own door basically was a trip. Not having to worry about like having to listen to the sounds outside just in case, that probably will never go away. But I don't know, having my own bathroom is the biggest thing. That was the best part of it here too. I definitely have more freedom with the security. I have more freedom to just go, and I don't have to carry around a 50-pound backpack with everything I've ever had in my life. I don't have to. I also can just go without having to worry about all of the several tasks I have to do before I leave. When I first heard that housing was an option, I didn't actually believe it, just because I've been on the streets for so long. It's just, come on now. But I just kind of went along with it. I mean, I wasn't doing anything else. So Christian helped me, like, with giving me the different requirements and what was being offered. It kind of like set it a little bit more in stone with, okay, maybe this is actually something that's going to happen, just because there was too many details for it to be fake. My biggest barriers for housing was income, and then my credit score is pretty messed up. So I first applied for a different housing or apartment complex, and they had approved me, but there was something on my credit score that needed to be taken care of first. We couldn't take care of it with what it was. And then I applied for this place, and I believe that him giving the promissory note is what set everything in stone. Like, they were okay with everything else because they didn't say anything about my credit. So the feelings or the words that I would use to explain would probably be, I feel peace because I have my own locked door now. Oregon All In has helped me feel a sense of security. Now that I basically have everything that I feel should be essential, now that I have all of that, I have so many more ideas and stuff that have been kind of put to the back burner that can come forward now to help progress. And that's kind of exciting. So really, so I guess the three words would probably be security, peace, and progressive.
Yeah.
Something like that. I really think that one of the biggest starts to helping every one of the houseless or whatever change this whole thing that we're all stuck in is to start maybe looking at the houseless as people again. And there are always a few bad nuts, but like, I think that'll help change a lot of issues that have been created out of it all. And honestly, when I was homeless, when somebody would look at me and treat me like I was still a person and not just garbage, that meant a lot more than anybody handing me money on the street or giving me a tent or anything like that. Just the fact that you still saw me as a person and actually noticed that I'm still here too, that meant more. So if we could, I don't know, maybe starting it, just like this whole program has saw me as a person. So that doing that more often with people is, I think that's what's going to be the biggest start to changing the whole problem. I have a job with PDX Saints Love. I basically, they call it the operational staff, but I give food whenever needed. I'm often doing hot coffee and cocoa for the winter, and distribute the gloves, hand sanitizer, or often advice on how to utilize those properly. So so just basically helping distribute to homeless whatever supplies that we can gather.
That was Jessica, a now formerly homeless individual who works with PDX Saints Love. Next, we go to Crystal Otero from the Joint Office of Homeless Services.
Hey, we are joined this morning by Crystal Otero, who is with the Supportive Housing Services team at the Joint Office and has been instrumental in getting the Supportive Housing Services measure off the ground. And this is now the third year of implementation of this metro measure here in Multnomah County and in Clackamas, Washington counties. Crystal, thank you for being with us today.
It's my pleasure. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah, I wonder if you could start by talking about what is the Supportive Housing Services measure for people who maybe aren't familiar with it.
Yeah, that's great. So in 2020, Metro government brought a ballot measure to people within the Metro region. And that region is defined by the urban growth boundary, or sometimes called the UGB. So voters that live within that boundary were able to vote on whether to approve a 10-year tax. It's called the Supportive Housing Services Tax. And the measure was 26-210. And the question was whether to tax individuals with incomes over $120,000 a year, or couples with over $240,000 a year, or businesses with over $5 million in gross receipts. I believe that's correct. So the voters said yes, and that passed. And so that initiated the Supportive Housing Services program across the region. And currently it's approved for 10 years. And so Clackamas, Washington, and Multnomah counties each get a percentage of the tax based on the percentage of the population that pays into it. So Multnomah County currently gets approximately 49% of the tax, and that comes to us through Metro. Typically, on a quarterly basis, we see a little bit trickle in because people are paying their taxes all year, but the majority of it comes in after April and then in the fall. Businesses, a lot of businesses pay their taxes near the end of the calendar year. So, so that's the sort of how the ballot measure works.
So all this money is coming in, and what's the focus of it? Where is it directed?
The focus of it, so there's three primary goals for the investment. So 75% of money spent on programming is for people that are experiencing chronic homelessness, which means that these are the people that make 0 to 30% area median income, have a disability, and have experienced at least 12 months of literal homelessness over the last 3 years. So 75% of the funds are for them, and the region is working to support on an annual basis 5,000 people that in our region that are experiencing chronic homelessness. And so for Multnomah County's planning, we're working to implement programs and services for approximately 2,300 people in that category of chronic homelessness. So the remaining 25% of programming goes to people that are experiencing housing instability. So this is anyone else who might be experiencing some form of homelessness or housing instability. So families that are doubled up, meaning, you know, one family is living in another family's home for a period of time while they look for another place to live. People that don't quite make enough to pay rent, and maybe that only happens 2 or 3 months out of the year, so they seek help with eviction prevention or short-term rent assistance. people who have a history of homelessness but have been housed but are needing support, people who received evictions, and people, some people who are fleeing domestic violence. Before SHS money, we, each of these counties, and in Multnomah County, we really had to follow the HUD guidelines for the chronic homelessness definition. And a lot of programs and services funded by the federal government really required strict adherence to these definitions. And those definitions, you know, are adopted nationally and are a requirement to receive that federal funding. So with SHS money, because that's a local source of funding, the region could add additional people that would qualify for services. And domestic violence programming is a good example of that, where previously somebody fleeing domestic violence wouldn't be considered chronically homeless or homeless in some instances because they were leaving a home to flee, right, an unsafe situation into a new situation. So with SHS money in Multnomah County, we've developed an expanded definition, which includes, you know, people that, you know, are 0 to 30% area median income and they have a disability. If they're fleeing domestic violence or sex trafficking, or some form of sexual or intimate partner violence, then they would be considered homeless or chronically homeless under our local definition. So then they would be eligible for services associated with that, like motel vouchers, housing placement programs. So that that's the power of having a local source of funding, is then the community gets to help decide what really falls into that definition or fits into that definition.
So it gives you more flexibility for helping more people. And what's been the success rate in these first 3 years of getting people into housing? And are there new housing units being created through this program?
Absolutely. I think we've seen great success. You know, in our first year, we about 1,000 people, additional people, because our system overall has other funding streams. So in the first year, I think we, SHS contributed to about an additional 1,000 people being placed into housing on long and short-term housing, in long or short-term housing programs. And in addition, in our second year, we saw similar numbers, so about maybe 1,100 people overall. So this is great. I mean, this is an additional, we're building out additional capacity to serve people. What we are hoping in this third year is really to see full implementation. And so we anticipate seeing an increase in housing placement, the rate of placement. And there's a couple of key projects that have been moving forward. One is the SHS money has helped us create a local voucher program, and it's called the Regional Supportive Housing Services. It's called the Regional Long-Term Rent Assistance Voucher Program, or called ARLA. So this is amazing. Like, for example, if you heard about, it's sometimes called Section 8 or Housing Choice Vouchers. So these are vouchers that the federal government funds. And, you know, in Multnomah County, the wait list for these vouchers, or sorry, the lottery for these vouchers has opened up about twice. Most recently, it opened up last year. And so people in Multnomah County got onto this, you know, submitted applications to be a part of the lottery. And I think there were about 27,000 people in Multnomah County that applied, and the lottery could only take about 7,000 people. So, you know, and then to get into the lottery means your name may be pulled. So they will hold this list of people in the lottery until they have new vouchers. They don't know when that will be. So the list is closed, and, you know, maybe in 3 to 5 years, it may open again. So that's all to just say, we don't have enough money to meet the need of services, especially if we're just reliant on the vouchers the federal government provides. So with SHS money, we can create a local voucher program and set our own priorities of who sort of can access those vouchers first. And so with that program, over the last 3 years, we currently have added 1,000 vouchers. So I most recently looked at the data, and we have just over 1,000 vouchers in Multnomah County that are those local ARLA vouchers. And so this has been one of the biggest successes of the Supportive Housing Services measure.
So I gotta ask, because it's something that comes up a lot about this measure, is you said, okay, there's not enough money to meet the need, but in the first 3 years of implementation, this measure has underspent. And I know that's a concern for people, that here is money coming in that's not being spent, when we see this need on the streets and we see more people entering homelessness, we see visible homelessness, and it seems like the money is not being spent fast enough. And I just wonder if you can address that concern.
Absolutely. You know, we have this big initiative. We have a number of people that are experiencing extreme poverty. They're on the street. A number of people have spoken publicly about not understanding how to access services. And that makes sense. You know, that makes a lot of sense to me, working within the field of developing homeless services. And so I think the criticism is absolutely right. What I can share with you is just some of the implementation challenges with working with the level of funding that, you know, the tax has generated. The first challenge has been contracting for new services. So the SHS money had basically doubled the Joint Office's budget, which means, kind of in essence, that we would expect to see is almost like a doubling of programs that we're contracting and delivering. What has been challenging is, for so many years, homeless services was really on a shoestring budget. So we have a lot of providers. Many of them maybe didn't have a government contract, right? And so they're working within collaboratives to provide services, but we didn't have a lot of resources. So now we're in a resource-rich environment, and so we want to fund this doubling of capacity. And we may not have, you know, providers that are ready right now to deliver services, but we want to have a diverse mix of providers. So we don't necessarily just want to award money to the big contractors, you know, that have over 1,000 employees and many programs. We need them. They're sort of like our backbone organizations that really keep our system moving, and they have the ability to expand capacity. We want to do that there, but then we also want to bring in providers that haven't historically worked with the government, because in many instances, those providers are working with communities that aren't working with anyone else. So if we want to reach people on the street, we need to bring in more providers that already have those connections. So bringing in new providers is just taking some time. And we've, you know, our first year, we spent developing a process so that they could become qualified for contracting. In our second year, we really worked to hold competitive processes all year to allocate that money. What we found last year, when we held those competitive processes, that then there were a number of administrative and bureaucratic steps that delayed the contract from being finalized and from money moving into their to their organization. So that has to do with, when you double programming and capacity, really you have to have the internal staffing to handle that volume. And similarly to many of our providers being on a shoestring, the county's joint office had also kind of been on a shoestring. You know, we weren't a department for a long time. We were what was called a division. And so we had less administrative staff to like process contracts and process invoices. So last year we really faced a lot of those challenges. So I think we saw probably maybe a 20 to 30% increase in contracting needs over the course of the year. And it was just created some delays. So this year we are moving to a different strategy in terms of holding some competitive processes. Again, we want to have transparent competitive processes to bring in new providers. Also targeting some allocations to contracts where we know the feasibility to expand is best within those providers. So we're getting a sense of it.
The idea is to be fair while also making sure that the money is being spent and getting out there. In order to be fair, you're working with new providers that maybe are doing culturally specific services?
Absolutely, yeah. Providers that are doing culturally specific services or providers that are doing sort of innovative outreach, programming. Yeah, we want to bring in those providers.
And can you just maybe walk us through what is process of someone who is on the street getting into housing? What are some of the barriers that people face and the reason that this kind of intensive case management and staffing is necessary? I mean, some people say we could just, you know, give people a voucher and let them, you know, just hand out vouchers to people on the street. Why not do it that way? And what are some of the things that need to happen in order for someone to get into housing?
Yeah, that's great. That's a great question. So the majority of people actually that enter homelessness leave on their own, and we don't provide services to them. There are a percentage of people that become homeless and they can't leave it on their own. And some of the reasons for that are property debt. They might have, you know, $5,000 or $10,000 of property debt. The amount is insurmountable for them, but they might not realize we have county programs to help pay that property debt. You know, another challenge might be housing discrimination. You know, if somebody's been to prison, somebody has, quote, bad credit, or discrimination based on protected identities like age, race, sexual orientation. Those types of things, we know a number of people experience housing discrimination. Working directly with clients, you may work with someone who's applied for housing 15 times over the last 2 or 3 years and never moved forward. So we have our case, many of our case managers are trained in how to address that and navigate it. Also, when we have programs like this, instances of housing discrimination are reduced because we have more people involved with that process. You know, some other challenges that people might face are that they have physical disabilities that they really need somebody to provide assistance around getting reasonable accommodations in place. And then finally, people who've experienced evictions that are on their record, they can face many challenges to renting. And so for people, you know, it's on a spectrum, and we have housing services on a spectrum. But for people who need sort of our highest level of service-enriched housing, permanent supportive housing, we have different landlord incentives to rent to folks that may have had a history of high property debt or eviction. And, you know, we will provide additional funding to say, we have like insurance on this person and we will, you know, pay for property debt, or we will provide more on-site tenant support to ensure the success of that.
Well, I think for this, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you, Crystal Otero from Supportive Housing Services, for joining us on Out of the Streets of Portland this morning.
Thank you for the opportunity.
That was Crystal Otero with the Joint Office of Homeless Services. More information about the Supportive Housing Services measure, including the 2023 annual report, can be found at johs.us/SHS. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Out of the Streets of Portland. This podcast is produced by the Joint Office of Homeless Services, a Multnomah County department with funding from the county, the City of Portland, Metro, and the state and federal government to house, shelter, and provide street outreach, navigation, employment assistance, assistance obtaining Social Security income, and case management to people experiencing homelessness in our community. Please subscribe to our podcast to get notified every time a new episode is posted. You can find us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts by searching for Out of the Streets of Portland. And you can find this podcast, along with a ton of information, data, and reports, at our website, johs.us. Thanks again for listening to Out of the Streets of Portland.
Listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland.
From the Coast Range Association, this is Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gaskill. So I don't have to tell anyone listening to this that here in the West, wildfires are a fact of life. I'm also sure that most folks listening are already aware that the climate crisis, combined with more and more homes